Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading it together today, the World Radio Online Edition for October 2011. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. We always spell our Handyham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. So again, it's handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with the World Radio Online News Front. Mumbai official looks to HAMS for MCOM support after serial terrorist blast rock Mumbai, India, knocking out phone lines in July. Maharashtra Chief Minister Prithviraj Chauhan said the State Home Department would purchase amateur radios for emergency communications, Rediff.com reported. It is estimated there are 16,000 ham operators in India. The 200-member Mumbai Amateur Radio Society provides communication support during religious and social festivals, sets up quick response teams for communications during emergencies, and has monitored flooding during monsoon season. Quoting, the organization was mobilized during the 2006 Mumbai train bombings, 2005 Maharashtra floods, 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake, and the 2001 Gujarat earthquake to provide the necessary communications links after established modes of communications were severed, the report said. More than 2,000 field day log submissions sets record. The American Radio Relay League reports that a record 2,654 log submissions have been received for the 2011 ARRL Field Day. According to ARRL Field Day Manager Dan Henderson, call N1ND, this is the highest number of entries received for the annual Emergency Operations and Contesting event. The first ARRL Field Day was held nearly 80 years ago in 1938. We thank ARRL for that commentary. The force behind Dayton CW pileup competition becomes a silent key. Tom Hammond, called N0SS of Loman, Missouri, died August 4 from cancer. He was 67. Mr. Hammond was the first life member of the Kansas City DX Club, it's the KCDXC, playing a critical role in the club for more than three decades and creating his world-famous CW pileup file each year for the annual CW pileup competition at the Dayton Hamvention. He was a life member of the American Radio Relay League and a member, by invitation, of the First Class Operators Club, FOC. Mr. Hammond's other affiliations included membership in the International DX Foundation, CW Operators Club, Amateur Radio Emergency Services, and for many years was coordinator of the local certified volunteer examiner program. An obituary appeared in the newstribune.com, can be seen at http://bit.ly/nvkwi0. He was also an avid and award-winning contester and the past president and current trustee of the Mid-MO, Mid-Missouri, I take it, Amateur Radio Club. Mr. Hammond served as a designer, troubleshooter, and beta tester for Elcraft, Incorporated of Aptos, California. We thank the ARRL, Missouri News Tribune.com, and KCDXC for this obituary for the gentleman, Mr. Hammond. High-achieving 11-year-old named Young Ham of the Year. 11-year-old Caitlin Cole, KS3P of Harvest, Alabama, has been chosen Amateur Radio Newsline's 2011 Young Ham of the Year. Among other noteworthy achievements, Kull served as a net control station during 2 weeks of emergency nets following the Southeast tornado outbreak of April 27. The award was presented at the Huntsville Hamfest in August. CQ Amateur Radio Magazine is a co-sponsor of the YHOTY program, providing winners with a free week at Space Camp. Caitlin is the 26th Newsline Young Ham of the Year and the youngest to date. We thank CQ Newsroom for that one. Continuing in World Radio Online, we have a sad commentary here. Antenna accidents kill one radio ham, injure three others. One radio amateur was killed and three others were injured recently in two widely separated antenna accidents. Tim Anderson, called K0OR, was killed and Tom Embry, NC0K, was seriously injured when a 110-foot tower they were helping to disassemble in Hot Springs, South Dakota, collapsed on them. According to the ARRR letter and the Amateur Radio News Line, all but the bottom 30-foot section had been taken down when the accident occurred on July 16. Both men were on the tower, and fellow members of the Hot Spring Amateur Radio Club were beginning to release the guy wires when a gust of wind toppled the tower section. In Texas, two hams taking down an inverted V antenna at the Wichita Amateur Radio Society's Field Day site received electric shocks after a strong wind gust blew a guy wire or the antenna's feed line into a power line. The ARRR letter reports Danny Caldwell, AD5IP, and Mike Byrne, AE5OC, were taken to Parkland Hospital in Dallas for treatment and later released. Club officials said all safety precautions were being observed. And here's another one of those vanity call sign fee jumps to $14.20. The cost to obtain a vanity amateur radio call sign in the United States increased 90 cents on September 9, jumping from $13.30 to $14.20. The FCC announced a price hike for a 10-year amateur radio license term on August 10, allowing 30 days for implementation. What else is new, huh? Thanks to the ARRL for all that good news. Hi. Heathkit announces return to the kit business. Some of you old-timers might remember the Heathkits. They were sort of fun to build. I even built one once a long time ago. Heathkit says it is re-entering the kit business that it abandoned almost two decades ago, according to a report on Amateur Radio Newsline. According to a posting on the Heathkit Educational Systems website, the company has debuted a new line of do-it-yourself kits for common around-the-house items. Quoting here, don't look for ham radio gear to be a top priority. Oh, really? The ARM report said, even though the word on the street is that kits for the amateur radio market may be down the pike. Continuing the quotation, right now the company is starting off with more general kits, with its first entry being a garage parking assistant, which uses ultrasonic sound to locate a car as it enters the garage, helping the driver position the vehicle. The system signals to the driver using LED lights mounted on the wall when the car is detected and a perfect spot for parking. Next on the market will be a wireless swimming pool monitor kit, followed by many more items. Well, I guess that's the way Heathkit wants to get back into the kit business. We can't stop them, folks. Let's hope they really get into that ham radio stuff sometime soon again as well. Well, let's go to a lighter side right now with the editor's log. The editor, of course, is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. He titles this one, "The Dumb Things We Radio Geniuses Sometimes Do." The biggest goof I did while a novice, wrote Corey Sickles, WA3UVV, from Glassboro, New Jersey, was when I added a couple of neon pilot lights to the front of my Heathkit DX20. It seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, some of the most entertaining moments during World Radio Online's monthly live internet chat sessions come when great stories just pop out of nowhere. Corey's was a classic. In August, the group somehow got on a jag about the dumb things we've done as radio amateurs. We laugh about them now, as painfully embarrassing as they were at the time. The story continues with UVVs, that's a WA3, UVV's transmitter powered up, and quoting, slightly out of the case. Corey had grabbed the front panel, wrapping his fingers around it, making contact with the power connection to those lights. Now, in full zap mode, I couldn't let go, he said, but somehow managed to run backward until I was pulled the cable out. My grandfather came downstairs and wanted to know what the hell was going on and why I made such a loud grunting sound. When he saw me still sitting on the floor with the DX-20 in my lap, I didn't have to say a thing. Corey's story was especially uplifting to me, for such a move was a rite of passage in that ham era. He validated me as a radio amateur. As a novice in the mid-1960s, I'd remove the high-voltage supply from a discarded TV set and reconstructed it in an upside-down gray metal file tray, 5U4 tube rectifier and all. Oh, boy. It would power the transmitter and receiver I was building at a radio called WN1DWL. One day I lugged this 15-pound behemoth on the school bus to school to show my ninth grade science class. Standing behind the experimentation table at the front of the room, wet bar, Bunsen burners and all, I proudly displayed the power supply and with panache connected a foot-long piece of yellow hookup wire to the 350-volt DC terminal. By the way, this was an extremely low-budget, low-intelligence project, fuses not included. For drama, the plan was to drag the exposed end of that yellow wire across the metal chassis, sparks flying everywhere. What a crowd-pleaser, I thought, amid a chorus of oohs and ah. Oh, how the tables would turn. Hold it up, shouted the kids in the back, wanting a better view. Happy to oblige, I managed in the process to somehow get my body between the 350-volt DC terminal and ground. Like Corey, I couldn't let go, locked in near rigor mortis with voltage, current, and indescribable mortification coursing through me. The power supply had mysteriously made its way above my head. In shock, terror, I shuffled wildly across the front of the classroom trying to let go, Michael Jackson style. It's not clear if the AC plug was ripped from the wall or my will to live gave me superpower, but the supply eventually crashed to the floor. The 5U4 exploded in a flash. Two aluminum electrolytic capacitors now teetered loosely like twin towers of pizza. The metal file tray was bent beyond recognition, much like me. Of course, the class erupted with delight. Best show and tell ever! I wasn't so sure. The teacher, standing in the back of the classroom with arms folded across his chest, just shook his head. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, he said. You may now take your seat. In the annals of amateur radio evangelism, probably not one of our prouder moments. Not another word was said until that painful bus ride home. Now, for you listeners, the final part of the editor's log by Richard Fisher, his commentary about the online programs that he produces every so often, the next one is going to be October the 2nd. It starts out with the title, 241, WRO PopCom Live Online Chat, October 2. For several months, we've been conducting separate live online chat sessions for World Radio Online and Popular Communications Magazine. That's another of their publications, Popular Communications. They've been great places for the communications community of each publication to gather and digitally chew the rag. Several participants have asked if it would be possible to combine both sessions into a WRO PopCom combo so readers of both publications can meet in the same place at the same time. Let's give it a try. Our first WRO PopCom chat-a-thon will be Sunday, October 2. We'll be gathering at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 0 UTC, UTC, Universal Time Constant, on the WRO online blog. I'll give you this on the internet for those of you that have capability. It's http://www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com. Simply go to the Cover It Live window there at chat time, click, and you're in. If you'd like to go to the site now and sign up to receive an email reminder, you can do that as well. Hope to see you and hear you on October 2nd. Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think I have a treat for you today. We have our first lead-off article with the Handy Hams. As many of you know, these recordings are provided for both the Massachusetts Reading Network, known as the Talking Information Center, which goes throughout New England and, of course, the world on the Internet, and the Courage Handy Ham System in Golden Valley, Minnesota. The director for the Handy Hams is Patrick Tice, called WA0TDA. This article is titled Signals and Smiles in the Air at Handy Ham's Radio Camp 2011. First, a quotation. Advise Mayberry PD that telephone communications are down at the National Weather Service. We have only limited dot alliance, but we do have amateur radio communications. Close quote. Don't panic. It was only an exercise, one of many amateur radio activities conducted at the Handy Ham Radio Camp this summer at Camp Courage near Maple Lake, Minnesota. Handy Ham members gathered for the annual week of amateur radio education, on-the-air activities, fellowship, and camp fun in early August so they could take advantage of the wonderful Minnesota lake country and near-perfect weather. In a sense, Radio Camp has returned to its roots at Camp Courage, originally conceived as a weekend retreat in the late 1970s. The annual summer gathering has evolved over the years to include licensing classes taught in adapted formats for the people with disabilities who attend the camp, and operating skills training ranging from getting on the air for the first time all the way up to the latest developments in technology for the experienced operator. The transceivers set up at the several stations at camp include voice chips that speak the frequency for blind operators and operating desks designed to allow a motorized wheelchair user to get comfortably situated to operate the radio. The Handy Ham office moved to Camp Courage in late 2009 after decades in the main Courage Center building in Golden Valley, Minnesota. It was a big move, but a good one, because it gave the program much-needed office and storage space and put us back in touch with our roots at Camp Courage. Now, under the subtitle Remote Radio Activity, we already had a 50-foot tower and beam antenna situated on top of the hill, the highest point in camp, so some of our infrastructure was in place when we arrived. Since then, the camp has become home to our popular internet remote-based high-frequency HF station called W0ZSW, which is available to Handy Ham members whose living situations make it difficult for them to put up HF antennas. One of our operating skills training options this year was how to install the remote-based software and operate the remote base from a computer. Handy Ham volunteer Lucinda Moody, called AB8WF, was in charge of the small group training sessions that included working with several of our blind operators using a computer equipped with screen reading software. That would be the way that they operated the remote base from their home locations. Volunteer Don Rice, call N0BVE, had already installed an EchoLink-enabled 2-meter repeater, but also took the time to return to camp to set up a 70-centimeter machine with an auto patch. These additional resources have enabled us to help campers learn how to use EchoLink from their handheld radios and how to use an auto patch. Susie White, called WA6DKS, donated an IRLP board, and Lyle Kohler, KSLR, our volunteer engineer, modified a Kenwood mobile radio and a tower computer that make up a complete IRLP simplex node for the IRLP training. Surprise! No code and an emergency. But guess what? New technology notwithstanding, there was still enough interest in good old Morse code to have several sessions of code technology and training. Ken Silberman, KB3LLA, and Bill Roach, N6HBO, enjoyed helping several code newbies, as well as some experienced but slightly rusty code operators. ARRL Eastern Massachusetts Section Manager Phil Temples, K9HI, designed and organized a two-hour emergency communications simulation. "It's a scripted exercise," explained Phil. "We ask camp staff stations at each simulated location to open envelopes containing the instructions at specific times. Then the campers relay the necessary information about the situation in their own words. They are in charge of communicating, just as they would be in a real emergency," explained Phil. "Our exercise was a response to a flood in the fictional town of Mayberry. Our operators were challenged by rising water, a stranded motorist, the birth of a baby at a shelter, loss of communications at the Mayberry police station, a net control station challenged to decide whether it was more important to take traffic from the National Weather Service or the Mayberry police, a house fire in a location blocked by floodwaters, reports of looters, and queries to shelters about supplies and pet facilities." Whew, that was quite a challenge, huh? "Does your shelter have horses?" asked Matt Arthur, KA0PQW, throwing in a little extra that was not part of the script.
"No, we do not have horses, only small pets," answered Rachel Nitheringhouse, KC0VBV, without missing a beat.
I might add that Rachel is pictured here in the article. She was the unflappable person as the voice of the fictional Pine Street shelter during the MCOM exercise.
"I knew I could do it," she said.
We had originally planned to introduce some unintentional interference in the form of a couple of stations who would get on the repeater for a casual QSO, unaware of the emergency situation in progress, explained Phil. But when the exercise looked like it might run a little long, we decided to drop the interference, and we came out just right. We finished about 3 minutes shy of our allotted 2 hours. And here's a note of interest, actually, for some of you New England listeners that hear this report on the Massachusetts Radio Network. Our volunteer instructor and donor, Phil Temples, K9HI, who organized and conducted the MCOM training exercise during Radio Camp 2011, is shown here, a very nice photograph of quite a few of the volunteers around, learning and understanding and enjoying the operation of the activity that Phil put together. Phil is the ARRL, American Radio Relay League, Eastern Massachusetts Section Manager, and he provides information technology, IT, for the Courage Handyham system. They have a wonderful website. It's www.handyham.org. And our close friend, Phil Temples, K9HI, does an awful lot of fine work for the amateur community as well as many other people in the Boston area. Now, continuing with the report, Bon Voyage. Some parts of amateur radio cannot be learned without actually experiencing on-the-air activities. Running a station from a pontoon boat is not only a fun activity, but it teaches real-world operating skills, and no one knows that better than Handyham volunteer Bill Jones, call N0CIC, our pontoon boat captain. Now, he's actually pictured on page 18 of the October 2011 World Radio Online, doing his job on that pontoon. It shows him checking out the twin supporting mobile high-frequency antenna. And guess what? He does have a vice preserver on. And a boy, we caught you off guard, we thought, but we didn't. Bill Jones and 0CIC. Bill is a regular on the Pico net, a 75-meter single sideband net and popular upper Midwestern place to gather for amateur radio operators. He lives on a lake and has volunteered as boat captain at many radio camp sessions. Bill also helps us maintain a second remote base station called W0EQO at Camp Courage North, near the headwaters of the Mississippi in northern Minnesota. Tech licenses make for happy campers, of course. The licensing classes are vital to the camp experience as well. The technician course introduces our campers, ages 16 through adult, to amateur radio. I consider it our most important class because its participants will be amateur radio operators when they pass their final tests. And after those tests were taken, the instructors gave thumbs up after a session for technician candidates at the radio camp of 2011. A photograph here shows Bill Roach, N6HBO, the instructor, Lucy Kretschiel, KE6QNX, who upgraded to tech from novice, Bill Vokuk, K9BV instructor, Mary Cochran, New Ham, John Honschel, N0BFJ instructor, Pauline Betley, New Ham, and instructor Larry Huggins, KA0LSG, and also Mike Erickson, a New Ham, and Pat Tice, WA0TDA, Andy Ham manager. It's always nice to see smiling faces, isn't it, huh? And of course, to pass those exams that's required by the Federal Communications Commission to get an amateur radio license, there have to be a lot of studies involved. And we begin by teaching online with our own audio lectures and with the excellent ARRL and the Gordon West study materials. And of course, during the entire week prior to the exams, the instructors we had just mentioned in the photograph, Bill Vokuk, Larry Huggins, and Bill Roach, work directly with our technicians candidates, technicians being the first licensed class now in amateur radio. Out of seven, four passed, and were able to send them home with new dual-band HTs, Handy Talkies, thanks to the generosity of Handy Ham supporter John Glass and U6P, who supplied us with the new Wuxian amateur radios. And continuing on that thought of providing radios to those in need. But other campers needed radios, too, and that's where volunteer Lee Lawrence, WB0T, R.A. was able to help. He spent the week organizing and testing equipment that could then be sent back home with operators who needed it. Donated equipment would thus find new homes on the air again. Lee was also instrumental in helping us test and set up the camp stations at the beginning of the week and then taking them down again. That's a challenge. I myself participated in that a few years back when they had a camp in Malibu, California. That was a lifetime experience for me too, folks, your reader, Bob. The time flew by. We welcomed the Stillwater Amateur Radio Association VE, volunteer examiner team that gives the tests by the FCC, led by Shell Mann and Zero DRX, and finished the week. Sometimes I think these camps could even be a little longer. Hidden transmitter hunts, licensing classes, boat rides, emergency communications exercises, hands-on learning of new technologies, and even the traditional campfire with songs. It all makes for a great week of ham radio learning disguised as fun. None of it would be possible without the help of hams helping hams, donors, volunteers, campers, and Courage Center staff. All of us working together. It's really the best amateur radio has to offer. Know someone with a disability who might benefit from our services? Here's our contact information. Courage Center Handy Ham System. Incidentally, Handy Ham is always spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, Handy Ham. So it's Courage Center Handy Ham System. 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN, 55422. You can call us at 1-866-HANDY-HAM. Numerically, that is 1-866-426-3442. You can email anytime at lowercase, one word, hamradio at CourageCenter, one word, .org. So that's hamradio@CourageCenter.org, or a website, http://www.handyham.org. So that completes the article with the Handy Hams titled Signals and Smiles in the Air at Handy Ham Radio Camp 2011 by the director, Patrick Tice. Call Whiskey Alpha Zero, Tango Delta Alpha, WA0TDA. Much of the material that I select in these different ham radio magazines that you folks have been able to listen to and hopefully enjoy with me here on the Massachusetts Radio Network on their Leisure Pursuits commentary. It's on once a month for the ham community as a hobby. But also, for those looking for ways to get into the amateur radio hobby itself, it takes a little bit of effort, learning, licensing, but it takes a little bit of money. Now, here's a strategy for buying ham gear in troubled economic times. It's sort of how you start on the cheap, if you will. Hi. The author is Corey G.B. Sickles. Call WA3UVV. First, he comes out with a big photograph. It shows a whole radio station setup. The reason I put it in here right at the moment is because the commentary tells it all about the picture. Sometimes a cup of change is all you need to buy used radio gear and accessories to get on the air. In this case, the vintage Heathkit DX40 transmitter, Heathkit VF1 VFO, homebrew gear, and a Hallicraft S38B receiver. They're all spread around the tabletop here, all for about $35. The computer mouse, which fits pictured here, serves as a keyer paddle. That's for Morse code operation. It's very imaginative. I must say, this stuff is very old, but if it still works, I gotta tell you, for $35, you can't go wrong. That's assuming it all works. Hi. But anyway, the article goes this way. Amateur radio is so much like other interests or hobbies. You can start small, and before you know it, fill a room with all the goodies you've acquired. In the case of ham radio, it might be impressive to visitors, but could leave the impression that ours is an expensive hobby. While you certainly can invest many thousands of dollars in radios, accessories, and antennas, it is not a financial requisite to getting on the air and having fun. In fact, both new and experienced hams can assemble a station and make contacts for very little money. That's certainly an advantage in these troubled economic times. With some selective purchasing and heeded advice from an Elmer, we call mentors in amateur radio an Elmer, you may find that you can happily be on the air for less than $200. In fact, that figure could even be $100 or less. There are strategies for finding inexpensive radios, for incorporating everyday items as accessories, and to funding your pursuits in an almost invisible way. Whether you just passed the license exam, and if so, congratulations, or you're an old-timer, a basic setup will consist of a transmitter, receiver, antenna system, and power supply. If you think about it, the simplest of these combinations is found in the handheld radio. For about $100, you can find a new 2-meter rig that fits in your palm. With some batteries, you're on the air. And a lot of those $100 radios also come with a battery, often a Nicklad or one of those longer-lived battery types that work quite well for a long time, if you don't drop them in water, I suppose. Operation on high frequency, that's HF, that's the frequencies 160 through 10 meters, is where it gets more challenging. To start working HF, high frequency, with as little cash outlay as possible, QRP, that's low power output, and CW operation, which is Morse code, kit building, and wire antennas are natural options. While low power
And Morse code may sound like too much of a challenge. Remember for a moment that this is the path followed by many hams, including me, as we became members of the community through the Novice License Program. In the early 1970s, when I became a novice, that was the first level of FCC examinations you had to pass, I limited my activities to CW operations, again that's Morse code, with 75 watts maximum input power, which at best meant for me about 40 watts output, on portions of the 80, 40, and 15 meter bands. My transmitter was crystal controlled. While this may not sound like the foundation of fun for some people, I assure you, the thrill of my first QSO, conversation between two people, between Pennsylvania and Texas with 15 watts, was an emotional event I still vividly remember today. Let's return from this nostalgic moment and figure out how to pay for all this fun. Many household budgets seem stretched these days. Students may find this even more. However, there is a simple way to save up funds. Spare change. At the end of the day, take the change you have in your pocket and put it in a container that's just for ham radio. Over time, the amount will grow, and you will soon discover there's enough in the jar, cup, or box to help you get on the air. Yes. This takes some patience and self-discipline, but it's worth the effort. When I was first married, money was a bit tight, but it was how I supported my ham radio habit in those early years. Now say that each day you put away just 75 cents. In about 7 weeks, you will have enough money for a QRP transceiver kit such as the Rock Mite or the Little Squall, and paid for with money you'll never miss. If you have a little more patience and loftier goals, at the end of each day, try depositing the dollar bills from your wallet into the bank. That's your little private bank, of course, probably under your underwear. Chances are you'll have enough money to buy a new multi-band, multi-mode HF rig in a year or so. Well, you'll be flying in. Let's take a look at some examples involving used gear. In photo A, there's a vintage Heathkit DX40 transmitter, a VF1 VFO, a homebrew carrier, and the Helicrafter S38B receiver. In fact, I mentioned that as I began the article. The computer mouse serves as a set of keyer paddles for the stuff, you know. The DX40 and the VHF cost $12. At a flea market. The receiver was found at a yard sale for $15. It's nice to go to yard sales where people are trying to get rid of Grandpa's old radio, folks, believe me. The key was $5 at a ham fest, and the mouse was $1. That brings our 40-watt CW station to a total outlay of just $33. Another few dollars for a light switch, that's what transmit and receive changeover, an electrical box connector, some surplus 75-ohm coax, tube transmitters are perfectly happy with it, and wire completed it all and brought the total of $45. Well, we're creeping a little ahead. About what you see in the measuring cup in the photograph. I've used this setup off and on for some time. While my solid-state digital gear has more bells and whistles, I have just as much fun, maybe more, with this bare-bones setup that brings back the thrill of those novice-era contacts. Notice also that the equipment was acquired from various sources. If you have a spare moment and find yourself near a yard sale, thrift store, or outdoor market, you might find that stopping to take a look around is time well spent. Well, let's go now to acquiring sideband gear. Okay, how about single sideband? In photo B, which is on page 9 of the World Radio Online edition, for October 2011, is a Tempo 1 HF transceiver,
circa 1970s. On top of it is an MFJ Enterprises MFJ9420, which is a single-band, 2-meter, 12-watt rig. Very basic stuff. Of course, it's old, remember? The Tempo 1 and power supply were picked up for $120. The used 9420 cost $150. And folks, before I flip the page, this Tempo 1, this is no cheesy rating. For the year 1970 that I mentioned a moment ago, it's very well hooked up for all kinds of capabilities in the upper frequencies of amateur radio for HF, single sideband mode, and others. It's not a cheesy piece of radio, and it's very, very inexpensive for $120 off someone's table somewhere. With the Tempo 1, you get 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10-meter operation with 100-plus watts out. That's very good. Why does the somewhat newer low-power rig cost more? Remember, there was another one showing there. I'm not entirely sure. It just does. Remember, you buy these at a yard sale or a ham fest, and whatever the seller wants for it and you're willing to give them, that's what you pay. That's the way the marketplace values things. Newer takes precedence over features. Take advantage of it. I spent another $10 for a high impedance microphone. Cleaned up the Tempo 1 a bit and had it on the air later that day. Rigs like the Tempo 1 are known as hybrids. They are a mix of solid state and tube technology. While not as stable as you would like for a PSK operation, they are fine for other digital modes, such as RTTY, which is radio teletype. One important note here, though, if you are at a ham fest or other venue and able to do a power-on test, then by all means do it. Some older equipment has been well taken care of and recently used. Other stuff, might have been abused and set on the shelf for years. Although electrolytic capacitors will dry up and need to be replaced, it's better to know what you are getting yourself into as far as a potential project before you buy. Now, the author continues the article just a little bit further by digging for diamonds in the rough, and he alludes to a photo C. While more than 30 years old, this is pictured here, a 5-band Swan SWAN-100MX transceiver obtained for $140. Still works just fine. Now, the photo brings us even a bit more current with an all-solid-state design in the 100-plus-watt radio, the Swan-100MX. For $140, I was able to acquire this rig, which is also a 5-bander. With a little tender loving care and some cotton swabs, it looks close to new. Another $5 for a hand mic and a converted PC power supply for free put me on the air in time to snag some Eastern European contacts on 20 and 15 meters the next day with the rig set up for 50 watts. I need to find a bigger free power supply. So in conclusion, try it yourself. Even if you use spare change to purchase accessory software or other filling in pieces for your station, you might soon be amazed by just how easily and inexpensively you can assemble and expand your station and enjoy amateur radio for many years to come. And as an editor's note, we'd like to hear from other radio amateurs who have developed creative ways of funding their hobby. Let us know about treasures you've found as well and how much fun you're having with them. You can send your commentaries by email along to worldradioonline@gmail.com. I think it's time now to take a look at Hamfest and special events. For the month of October, Queens, New York, the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club Hamfest will be held October 2 at the New York Hall of Science parking lot, Flushing Meadows, Corona Park, New York, in Queens, New York.
Doors open for vendors and set up at 7 a.m. The buyers are admitted at 9 a.m. There's free parking, door prizes, drop and chop, QSL card checking, food and refreshments. Norcross, Georgia, special event station N4V, November 4, Victor. October 8th from 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to commemorate the manufacture of the Vibraplex Bug in Norcross. The station will be also on the air all week near traditional HFQRP, that's low power frequencies. QSL can be made to N4TRB with a self-addressed stamped envelope. Wallingford, Connecticut, the Nutmeg Ham Fest and ARRL Connecticut State Convention will be held October 9 at the Mountain Ridge Resort, 300 High Hill Road, Wallingford, Connecticut. It's celebrating its 19th year. There will be an indoor and outdoor tailgating event that will feature door prizes. Mena, Arkansas, special event station, W5HUM, Whiskey 5, Hotel Uniform Mike, October 1. 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's celebrating the 80th anniversary year of Lum and Abner on the radio. Sponsored by Yochita Amateur Radio Association, W5HUM. Operating in the general class portion of 20, 40, and 80 meters, the first 25 contacts, get this, will receive a CD of Lum and Abner radio programs. And when wanting a special event certificate, please send an SASE to Don Thomas, 117 Dallas Lane, Mena, MENA, Arkansas, AR 71952. Denison, Texas, special event station W5I, Whiskey 5, India, October 15, from 1500 UTC to 2300 UTC, in celebration of the 121st birthday of Dwight Eisenhower, 34th President of the United States. The frequency, just one listed, 14.250. That's the 20-meter band. For QSL cards, send QSL and SASE to David Booth, 409 Umstead, U-M-S-T-E-A-D, Colbert, C-O-L-B-E-R-T, Oklahoma, O-K. In Sellersville, Pennsylvania, R.F. Hill, Amateur Radio Club Handfest. It's on October 16th at the Sellersville Firehouse, 50 North Main Street. Lufkin, Texas, Lufkin Hamfest 2011 will be held October 22 from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Lufkin First Church of the Nazarene. That's on 1604 South Medford Drive in Lufkin, Texas. And the National Wildlife Refuge, in commemoration of National Wildlife Refuge Week, October 9 through 15. Combine communication skill with enjoyment of the outdoors to help others learn about the National Wildlife Refuge System. Only authorized, safe, responsible access to refuges is sanctioned by this event. And projecting just a bit further into the month of November, the Holmdel, H-O-L-M-D-E-L, New Jersey, special event station KC2LSD, Kilo Charlie 2 Lima Sierra Delta, November 11 at the New Jersey Vietnam Veterans Memorial and Vietnam Era Museum and Educational Center. It's on 1 Memorial Lane, exit 16 off the Garden State Parkway. If in the area of the Golden State Parkway, New Jersey, the time is about, 1300 hours to 2000 hours universal time constant. Let's go quickly to the contest corner, the Tara Fall Classic PSK Rumble. That's 0 through 2359 Zulu October 1st. The bands there, of course, are 160 through 6 meter PSK only. The EU Autumn Sprint, 1600 to 1959 Zulu, 1 October, 80, 40, 20 meter single sideband. California QSO Party, that's always a blast. That's 1600 hours Zulu, 2 October through 2200 hours, 3 October, 160 through 2 meters. It's on single sideband, FM and CW. Oceana DX, 0800 Zulu, 1 October through 0800 Zulu, 2 October, 160 through 10 meters, single sideband. Here's the next interesting one, the FIST's
fall sprint, the 1700 through 2100 hour Zulu, 8 October, it's on 80 through 10 meters, CW only. It's a very popular contest for the old Morse code buffs, or the new ones as well for that matter. And it's always a lot of fun, so join them on the first fall sprint on October 8th. And also the North American sprint, 0 through 0400 Zulu, 9 October. The bands 80, 40, 20 meters RTTY. That's teletype for you plain speakers, so look forward to enjoying that also. And October 16th, the 10-10 International Fall, CW Digital, that's always a worldwide contest. It's 10 meters only, of course, both CW and digital. And one more really big one, CQ Worldwide DX Contest. That's 0 Zulu, 29th October through 2359 Zulu, 30 October, 160 through 10 meter single sideband. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a month I'm going to do a little bit of reading from Rules and Regs. It's a very popular article that appears in just about every issue of World Radio Magazine, but much of the commentary by the very fine writer John B. Johnston, called W3BE, is a little bit more on the technical side. And from my estimation as a reader, probably not the easiest stuff to comprehend for people that are just getting used to what we're talking about when it comes to radio. But this time, it has a very interesting message from my perspective to you. It's, are exams really necessary? For over 27 years under agreements with the FCC, our volunteer examiner coordinators, that's VECs, have recruited and accredited tens of thousands of volunteer examiners. Our 14 VECs must also cooperate in maintaining the question pools for our VEs. They have established themselves into the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, for which W3BE, the author here, has served as vice chairman. The following is from his report to the 2011 annual NCVEC conference held on July 29 in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Volunteer Examiner Coordinators. On behalf of our amateur service community, thank you for the great work that you do, and thank you for being here. As a point of contact with the Federal Communications Commission, it is essential that VECs get together at least annually to review what you are doing, confer with our regulators, and make plans for the future. Let's jumpstart this conference by focusing on our fundamental reason for being here. Recharge your mind from thinking about whatever it is that you otherwise would be thinking about, to concentrating on what it is that we should be doing to keep our volunteer examiner system on the right track. We will begin with our annual reality checkup. As coordinators supporting our 32,000 volunteer examiners who prepare and administer those hundreds of thousands of written examinations, the one question that we should always be prepared to answer is, are exams really necessary? Examinations are to enable our VEs to verify that every licensee is properly qualified for the privileges of an amateur operator license grant in places where the FCC regulates our amateur service. We will presume that everyone here believes strongly that examination is absolutely necessary. As you contemplate the presumption, please be mindful that our VEs make examination opportunities conveniently available practically everywhere. Consider also that our VECs do a splendid job in making known the content of our question pools. As it stands, when a person is even minimally qualified, he or she should have no difficulty in scoring at least our anemic D minus passing grade. But we know that not everyone shares our view. This divergence has to be addressed from time to time when we are challenged with arguments against our examinations and schemes to bypass them. They all have that one objective in common: make the exams go away for one group or the other who want access to our valuable radio spectrum.
You may have read the answers to some of these arguments. Here are five of the most popular that have been received and how they have been answered. Argument number one. We want as many people as possible with the FCC licenses. These burdensome examinations frighten away too many potential guarantees and are bad for business. The naysayers predicted that doing away with the CW exam would ruin a hobby. That did not happen, just as it also would not happen were those written exams to disappear. Must we really have exams? W3BE's response is yes. He states the source and states that each applicant must pass an examination for a new amateur operator license grant and for every change in operator class. Each applicant for each class of operator license grant must pass or otherwise receive examination credit for certain examination elements. The International Telecommunications Union Radio Communication Assembly additionally, the references here, states that administrations take such measures as they judge necessary to verify the operational and technical qualifications of every person wishing to operate an amateur station. Argument number two. The ITU recommendation is just that, a recommendation. It does not even suggest written examinations. So, can't the FCC change its rule? W3BE's response is yes, it certainly does have that flexibility. The Communications Act likewise does not stipulate examinations per se. It only requires our regulator to prescribe the qualifications of station operators, classify them according to the duties to be performed, fix the forms of such licensees, and issue them to persons found to be qualified. The FCC, therefore, would have to decide that some different way, other than our written examinations, is preferable when finding a person qualified to hold an amateur operator license grant. Argument number three. It is outdated reasoning that examinations are necessary to assume that hams will not construct interference-causing stations. That homebrewing era of circuit diagrams, piece parts, and soldering irons is history. Very few U.S. hams construct or repair their apparatus. They depend almost completely upon foreign-produced apparatus. Those 74 passing grades underscore the futility of the examinations. It means that whichever one quarter of our licensees' knowledge can be erroneous. The VEs are typically unconcerned about what it is that their examinee has just proven to have a flawed awareness. They seem to stand aloof from the content of your question pool's bank of needed knowledge. Emphasis on the technical aspects of amateur radio is giving way to shoring up operational shortcomings for professional emergency communicators. Technical know-how is irrelevant for them. Can't applicants just sign a statement of knowledge of the FCC rules? W3BE responds, possibly. The precedent is FCC Form 605. And NCVEC Form 605. They both require signing, among other things, this statement. I certify I have read and will comply with Section 97.13 sub C of the Commission's rules regarding radio frequency radiation safety and the amateur service section of OST/OET Bulletin Number 65. The ITU Radio Communications Assembly recommends that any person seeking a license to operate an amateur station should demonstrate theoretical knowledge of international and domestic radio regulations, radio telephony, radio telegraphy, and data and image methods of radio communication, transmitter, receiver, antenna, propagation and measurement radio system theory, radio emission safety, electromagnetic compatibility, and avoidance and resolution of radio frequency interference. Our examination system, moreover, enables our administrating VEs to follow up with each successful examinee at each exam session. They can timely review all questions missed and remedy any misunderstandings that their neophyte may have. Argument number 4. Nothing is more important than safety of human life. If signing a certification is the right way to determine whether the person has actually read and truly understands something as vital as the RF safety rule, it must likewise be the right way to determine whether the person has read and understood all of the rules. W3BE comments with a reference, however, states that each applicant must pass an examination for a new amateur operator license grant and for each change in operator's class. Our VEs are responsible for preparing and administering those examinations. Our VECs, question pools, moreover, do contain several questions on RF safety. Argument number 5. Does the FCC even have the authority to require amateur operator examinations? W3BE comments, the FCC obviously presumes that it does. Read the general powers of the Commission in the Communications Act of 1934 at Section 303, 47 U.S. Code. It states, 1. Exempt as otherwise provided in this act, the Commission, from time to time, as public convenience, interest, or necessity requires, shall, 1. Have the authority to prescribe the qualifications of station operators, to classify them according to duties to be performed, to fix the forms of such licenses, and to issue them to persons who are found to be qualified by the Commission and who otherwise are legally eligible for employment in the United States, except that such requirements relating to eligibility for employment in the United States shall not apply in the case of licenses issued by the Commission to A. persons holding United States pilot certificates, or B. persons holding foreign aircraft pilot certificates which are valid in the United States, if the foreign government involved has entered into a reciprocal agreement under which such foreign government does not impose any similar requirement relating to eligibility upon citizens of the United States. 2. Notwithstanding paragraph 1 of this subsection, an individual to whom a radio station is licensed under the provisions of this act may be issued an operator's license to operate that station. As other questions are received, they will be answered in future columns and on the W3BE Informed webpage, which is http://www.w3beinformed.org. Mr. Chairman, these volunteers are fully recharged and anxious to confer. May we now proceed? Thank you, and have a great meeting. And in conclusion, folks, read the rules, heed the rules, and visit www.w3beinformed.org for links to rules and information sites. Email your questions about the amateur service rules to J-O-H-N, that is to say, the name John, so it's john@johnston.net, john@johnston.net. He'll get a chuckle. I'm sure he'd appreciate your comments relative to this particular column. It's exactly what the man says it is. He's a fine individual who knows all about the rules and regulations relative to amateur radio in the United States of America. So it's good advice to follow the rules and heed the rules. And I must admit, I had a little fun playing along with the commentary. Thank you for your patience. Let's take a peek now at another article regarding promotion and recruitment. Promotion is a team sport. Tips for organizing a recruiting drive for your radio club. It's by Devere D. Logan, W1HEO.
Groups that stop growing can face a gloomy future. Radio clubs are no exception. Our amateur radio service must show healthy members to warrant protection and expansion of our spectrum from the FCC and other agencies. We were reading a radio club newsletter recently that pointed out that its board was looking for ways to promote the group to new hams. Ideas were solicited, including meaningful and desirable programs and activities for existing members. That certainly makes sense. Without a variety of ways to recruit and retain members, clubs may wither and die. So how can clubs do this and, most importantly, get members excited and motivated? What's the plan? An effective recruiting drive will begin with some type of plan that is understood and supported by members. Clubs with active members certainly have an advantage. As we've noted, promotion is very much a team sport. Lone individuals are seldom adequate to conduct a broad campaign with a variety of activities. The more elements in the plan, the more people will be needed to make it work. This will require team coordination by a leader, someone to take charge of the recruiting drive. Generally, most club members are happy to offer ideas, but not everyone is willing or able to step up and participate. So motivating people to participate is important. There are many ways to stimulate members to get involved. For example, offer free or discounted dues, cash awards, and prizes of radio equipment or accessories. The Cleveland chapter of the Quarter Century Wireless Association, the QCWA, ran a membership drive that awarded $100 to persons who signed up the most new members. Your club treasury may not allow such a liberal prize, so be creative. How about some sales tools? Most effective selling jobs begin by knowing your product. So one of the first requirements is to have a standard set of reasons why someone should join your club. These are your features and benefits, or, in the case of a non-AM, what amateur radio is and what it offers, including fun and public service. Everyone who participates in your recruiting program should know these features well and be prepared to discuss them. Often a printed handout can help. That would include the basic who, what, when, and where, information about your club, including the list of activities and recent programs. If your club is losing members, a survey may reveal areas that need to be improved. Informal calls to ex-members will often expose areas that need to be changed. Issues such as long, boring meetings, uninteresting programs, or unfriendly attitudes are typical and should be faced and corrected before the recruiting begins. This step is helpful in building a member-friendly club. For non-hams, the usual recruiting materials are useful, many of which can be provided by the American Radio Relay League, or found in radio magazines such as CQ Amateur Radio, Worldwide Online, CQ VHF, and so on. Showing a promotional video is an easy way to introduce people to ham radio. A DVD is available from the Ham Radio Promotion Project. The important thing is that everyone who is part of the recruiting drive is providing the same information, all of which is agreed upon beforehand by the membership. Certainly every club member should be familiar with the selling points. If your club has a website that provides contact names with telephone numbers or email addresses, complete recruiting information can be posted. Websites are handy for including the organization's newsletters, list of officers, meeting times and locations, etc. Use this as part of your promotion to area hams, former members, and others. Demonstrations of ham radio in action are probably the most effective showcase. This is why ARRL Field Day remains one of the most popular activities with promotional potential. Offering information to scout groups, youth groups, senior centers, civic clubs, and so on can pay big dividends. Displays also provide an easy way to introduce the public to radio service. Clubs can make their own promotional exhibit with lightweight portable 2- and 3-panel displays that can feature photographs of club activities, sample QSL cards, and much more. Often local libraries will welcome such a display and even develop a bibliography of amateur radio books available. Now, following through is very important.
After stimulating interest in your club and ham radio, then what? How do you turn interest into new members or potential licensees? In the jargon of the circus, you gotta get them into the tent. In other words, how do you close the deal by signing up new members? For licensed prospects, inviting them to a club meeting featuring an interesting program topic or guest speaker is a good way to start. Current club members should be encouraged to extend warm welcomes to arriving visitors and provide a short orientation about the club and its activities. Coffee or donuts could be provided during a pre-meeting social hour, during which club officers might be introduced along with visitors and other members. The Ham Radio Promotion Project provides club members with a 50-page toolkit describing how to conduct a complete campaign. Details are on the organization's website. One caution about recruiting young people. If your club is mostly mature seniors, try to make youth feel welcome. If possible, have your younger members offer special activities and gatherings apart from the regular programs. Youth often feel uncomfortable in presence of older people, so try to recognize this fact and use a different approach to recruiting that's on their wavelength. Remember to send your club newsletters to the press. Why? Sometimes it sparks reporters' interest in developing a story. So work at that, and we thank you for your time. And it's signed Devere D. Logan, W1HEO. D is an accredited member of the Public Relations Society of America, a veteran radio ham, active writer, and radio club supporter. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings me just about up to time for this month's reading of World Radio Online here on the Courage Handy Ham System. The editor for World Radio is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. World Radio is a production of the CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Your reader, my name is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, 50 miles south of Boston, right here on Buzzards Bay, on your way down to good old Cape Cod, the islands of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. If you'd like to contact me directly, I really don't mind. Any kind of constructive comments or criticism will be welcome. My email is my call sign, n1blf@comcast.net. Thanks again for listening along with me today, 73.